You know how when you're playing a long game of Monopoly and you've got your whole strategy locked
Oh
in?
yeah, you know exactly which properties you want.
Right. You're targeting specific squares, and then right in the middle of your turn, someone just reaches into the box, pulls out a brand new rule book, and announces that like the rent structure on the entire board works completely differently
It's
now.
just out of nowhere.
Yeah, completely out of nowhere. But, and here's the catch, if you already bought your properties before that exact moment, you get to play by the old rules forever.
Wow. So the entire strategy of the room just shifts instantly.
Exactly. The board looks the same, the pieces haven't moved, but the underlying mechanics of the game have been permanently rewritten.
And you're just sitting there, right, reevaluating every single move you thought you were going to make.
Yeah, calculating your cash, sweating a bit. Well, welcome to the reality of the Australian property market for your listening today, because today is June 1st, 2026.
Which is a huge date.
It is. That date means the clock is officially ticking on an absolutely massive structural shift in Australian property investing.
Yeah, for anyone holding property right now or, advising clients who do, we are standing in this very specific critical window of time. The landscape is basically bifurcating into two distinct eras.
Right, the pre-budget era and the post-cutover era.
Exactly.
And we are dedicating today's deep dive to understanding the actual mechanics of that transition. So for you listening, whether you're a broker navigating these changes, maybe an accountant, a property owner, or honestly just someone who closely follows how macroeconomic policy alters real-world market behavior, this analysis is for you.
It's going to affect everything.
It really is. And we are using a highly detailed piece from the Broker Times today, written by Jennifer Austin. It's titled Negative Gearing's 1 July 2027 Cutover, Restructuring Investor-Client Pipelines Before the Established Property Cliff.
Which is a mouthful, but Jennifer Austin's breakdown is it's particularly valuable because it cuts right through all the political noise. She focuses strictly on the operational mechanics.
Right, because we aren't taking any political sides here. We're just looking at the facts.
Okay.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to decode what actually broke structurally on May 12, 2026.
The budget night.
Exactly. We want to see how the major bank algorithms are reacting in real time and how the market is mapping out this 13-month window before the new laws officially kick in on July 1st, 2027. We are looking way past the headline anxiety to just examine the fundamental math.
Because honestly, whenever a core tax policy goes through this kind of reform, the initial market reaction is usually just reactive, pure panic sometimes.
Absolutely.
But by establishing a calm, analytical tone, which is what I want to do here today, we can focus on the practical why and how. We need to dissect why this policy alters the timeline of investment reward,
Yeah.
and really how lending institutions are being forced to adapt to it.
So to map this strategy, you first need a crystal clear picture of the May 12 announcement itself. Like, what are the new rules of the game?
Right, let's get into the mechanics.
So the headline policy is that negative gearing on residential property will be restricted solely to new builds starting July 1st, 2027.
Solely new builds.
Right. Meaning if you purchase an established property, like a normal existing house after that cutover date, the losses can no longer offset your wage or business income.
They are completely quarantined. Under the proposed legislation, those losses are carried forward.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
Meaning they can only be applied against future capital gains on that specific property when it is eventually sold. You can't use them year to year to reduce your income tax.
Wow. Okay, and then there's the second component, which is the capital gains tax, or CGT.
Right, the 50% discount.
Yeah, that long-standing 50% CGT discount, scrapped. It's being replaced by a hybrid indexation method, which establishes a minimum 30% tax floor on gains realized after the July 2027 cutover.
Unless, and this is a big, unless the asset is a new build.
Ah, right.
The source highlights that investors funding new construction will actually retain the option to choose whichever CGT method yields a better outcome for them.
Oh, wow. So they get to pick.
Exactly. It's clear the policy mechanism is designed to aggressively funnel investor capital away from existing housing stock and directly push it into new supply creation.
Which brings us to the linchpin of this entire transition, the magic word.
Grandfathering.
Grandfathering. Anything owned or unconditionally contracted before 7:30 p.m. on May 12, 2026 retains the old rule structure indefinitely.
Indefinitely.
You keep the negative gearing offset against your personal income. You keep the 50% CGT discount. It's like a golden ticket in a chocolate bar, right?
That's a great way to look at it.
If someone secured a standard established property on May 11, that asset effectively transformed overnight. It went from just a standard house to a highly exclusive, irreplaceable tax asset.
The physical bricks and mortar remain exactly the same, but its tax status has become a closed class asset.
But wait, so if I buy an established place today, my tax losses are just trapped inside that property.
Yeah.
Until the day I sell it. I can't use them to lower my income tax this year.
What's fascinating here is how that completely rewrites the cash flow model. When those yearly losses are stockpiled rather than refunded to you every year, property shifts. It goes from being a yearly income tax shield, which aids immediate cash flow, to a deferred capital gains play.
So you're trading immediate relief for some distant payoff.
Exactly. You are trading a known immediate tax mitigation strategy for a deferred benefit that just sits locked away for a decade or more. The holding costs increase significantly because the government is no longer subsidizing your monthly shortfall through your tax return.
And because that cash flow model is broken, the ripple effects are slamming straight into the lending sector.
Well,
right?
Head on. The banks are scrambling.
Because they have to alter how they assess risk. The source details how lenders' serviceability calculators are fundamentally failing under this new policy math.
Well, think about it. A bank's risk model is heavily predicated on an applicant's net after-tax cash flow.
Right.
When that negative gearing tax shield vanishes from an established property investment, the applicant's net monthly cash flow drops substantially in the eyes of the bank's algorithm.
And we are seeing lenders actively rewrite these algorithms right now. Like, NIB moved first, didn't they?
Yes, NIB was the first. They tightened their investor servicing assumptions for any post-budget purchases.
And then Brighton and ORE issued interim guidance. And now CBA and Westpac are updating their internal calculators. And this is even before the legislation has formally passed Parliament.
They can't wait for it to pass. The risk is too high. So if a borrower received a capacity estimate from a broker on, say, May 11,
it's fiction.
Completely obsolete today. The algorithms are essentially stressing the loan against a higher net holding cost.
Making it harder to borrow.
Exactly. When the bank strips the negative gearing benefit out of the income side of the serviceability calculator, the borrower's debt-to-income ratio worsens. And to keep that ratio within an acceptable regulatory risk band, the maximum loan size simply has to be reduced.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We are now dealing with a divergence in borrowing capacity based solely on the type of asset.
Yes.
For established properties, borrowing power is shrinking rapidly because the algorithms are pricing in the loss of that tax shield. But for new builds, capacity remains stable.
Or even improves.
Right. The source notes that in some updated models, it's actually improving because the negative gearing carve-out for new construction gets weighted positively against the new baseline. So one single client now has two completely different borrowing capacities depending purely on the type of house they want to buy. That is absurd.
It is a totally bifurcated lending environment. An applicant with the exact same income, the exact same expenses, same deposit, they generate two vastly different borrowing capacities, purely dependent on the construction status of the target property.
So the traditional question, you know, a buyer walking into a broker's office and asking, what is my maximum borrowing capacity?
That concept is dead.
It's gone. The conversation now centers on running what Jennifer Austin calls the dual scenario.
And running a dual scenario is the new baseline for professional competence right now. A broker cannot just provide a single capacity figure anymore. They must present scenario A, mapping the reduced capacity for an established property alongside scenario B.
Which maps the sustained or enhanced capacity for a new build.
Exactly. The client has to see that algorithmic divergence side by side to make an informed decision on where to put their capital.
And knowing that these bank algorithms are moving targets, navigating this 13-month window before July 2027 requires action. Doing nothing feels like a massive risk.
Oh, complacency will be incredibly expensive.
Right. So the article outlines a very specific three-part restructuring playbook for brokers and investors.
Yeah, the three-part conversation.
Step one.
Step one is confirming the grandfathering dates. It's the immediate operational priority. Investors must locate the execution documents for every property in their portfolio and verify the exact timestamp.
Because if it's before 7:03 p.m. on May 12th,
then that asset's golden ticket status must be explicitly documented and ring-fenced in their strategy.
Okay, so you confirm the dates. What's step two?
Step two is mapping intent. You look at the 36-month horizon and determine the objective. Acquire, hold, or sell.
Okay, and step three is running that dual scenario we just talked about.
Yeah.
But let's go back to step two for a second. For those looking to acquire, the market is developing this really aggressive strategy right now.
A compounding strategy.
Yeah. Investors are looking at their grandfathered properties and refinancing them in 2026 to extract equity so they can use that equity to buy new builds.
They are stacking the tax advantages. It's brilliant math, honestly. By holding the grandfathered established property, they keep the old negative gearing benefits on that specific asset. Then, by leveraging its equity to purchase newly constructed stock, the new asset also qualifies for full negative gearing under the post-2027 rules.
Wow. So they are maximizing their tax shields across both the old and new legislative frameworks.
Exactly. But doing that across a large client base requires serious operational bandwidth.
Yeah, the article says brokers need to be sending a one-page, plain English summary to clients, like by mid-June. No political commentary, just the math.
Just the math. And more importantly, it highlights that brokers must partner with 2 to 3 property tax accountants, because this requires a unified approach. Brokers simply cannot engineer these transitions in isolation.
The tax variables are just too complex.
Way too complex for napkin math. Collaboration between credit advisors and tax professionals is no longer optional. It's a structural requirement.
So what does this all mean for the sell intent? Like, if I map my intent and realize I probably want to sell a property in the next 3 years anyway, is it a panic move to sell before July 2027? Or is that just smart math to lock in the 50?
Precisely. You have to determine if you are better served taking a marginally smaller gross profit at a highly favorable tax rate today, or a larger gross profit at a significantly penalized tax rate tomorrow. And that exact calculation is why teaming up with accountants is the highest leverage move right now.
Okay, so we've covered the big investors, but this policy shift has massive blind spots that bleed into areas that I really doubt were the intended targets of the legislation.
Oh, unintended consequences are everywhere with this.
Right, like consider a younger owner-occupier purchasing their first home today. A super common strategy is to buy an established starter home, live in it for 5 to 7 years, and then eventually turn it into an investment property when they upgrade.
It's the classic rent vesting upgrade path. But if they execute that strategy with an established home purchased after the May 12 cutoff, they face a severe penalty when they try to convert it in, say, 2031.
Because it's an established property.
Right. It will not be eligible for negative gearing against their income. The holding costs upon conversion will be dramatically higher than they planned for.
Which means they're being forced to make a decade-long capital allocation decision today. Do they accelerate their upgrade timeline to beat the 2027 cutover? Do they pivot to buying a new build as their starter home just to preserve the future tax optionality? It alters life planning for even single property owners.
It absolutely does.
And the source also notes this applies equally to self-managed super funds or SMSFs that hold residential property. The tax-effective retirement models built around SMSF property holdings are facing a comprehensive rewrite.
And amidst all of this, we have to address the severe regulatory and compliance risks. Because as of today, June 1st, 2026, the legislation has not actually passed Parliament.
Right. It remains an announced policy intent. The expected passage is, what, Q3 2026?
Around then, yes. But crossbench negotiations are still happening. Minor parties are heavily debating exemptions for institutional build-to-rent developers and specific trust structures.
So financial professionals are being forced to architect these life-altering financial restructurings based on a rulebook that is literally still being drafted.
Yes. And the compliance directive from the source is incredibly rigid here. Any file note or written advice must explicitly state that the strategy is formulated based on announced policy. Not legislated law.
That's a vital distinction.
It is. But there is a secondary risk that is far more complex involving ASIC and the best interest duty.
The BID.
Right.
Wait, so a broker could map the perfect tax strategy with a new build, but still get in trouble because the construction lender isn't a good fit for the client's long-term life. It feels like they're being asked to walk a regulatory tightrope blindfolded.
This raises an important question about the balance between tax efficiency and long-term suitability. The best interest duty legally obligates a broker to recommend a credit product that is in the consumer's best interest.
Right.
With this new policy, recommending a new build might clearly be the superior move for the client's tax strategy. However, the specific construction lender financing that build might have, say, uncompetitive owner-occupier rates, or maybe they lack a functional offset account.
Making the loan itself a poor fit for their day-to-day life.
Exactly. The regulatory framework dictates that the tax tail cannot wag the suitability dog. The fundamental structure of the loan must serve the client's broader financial well-being, independent of the tax benefits.
I mean, I struggle to see how ASIC enforces this practically. If pivoting to a new build saves a client $12,000 a year in trapped tax losses, doesn't that massive financial upside inherently make it in their best financial interest? Even if the construction loan structure is a bit clunky or the rate is a few basis points higher, the net position is so much better.
It's a valid argument, but ASIC's view is generally that tax policies are subject to change, which, ironically, we are witnessing right now, while the contractual obligations of a 30-year credit facility are concrete.
Ah, I see.
If a broker prioritizes a tax outcome, but the underlying loan product causes operational friction or financial stress for the borrower, it breaches the duty of care.
So file notes have to be meticulous.
Meticulous. The file notes must explicitly capture both sides of the decision. The broker has to prove they evaluated the suitability of the lender's product independently and then justify how the tax positioning influenced the final recommendation without compromising the baseline financial security.
And layered on top of that compliance tightrope is the commercial reality of clawbacks.
Oh, the clawbacks.
If an investor uses that strategy we talked about, aggressively refinancing a grandfathered property to buy a new build, they have to be hyper aware of timing. Because refinancing a loan within 12 to 18 months of settlement often triggers a commission clawback from the bank.
It demands an incredibly disciplined operational cadence. You have professionals navigating pending legislation, shifting bank serviceability algorithms, stringent ASIC oversight, and advanced tax mathematics all simultaneously.
It's a lot. Pulling all these threads together, the core takeaway from Jennifer Austin's analysis is one of proactive leverage. The July 2027 cutover might feel far away on a calendar, making it tempting to just defer action. But this 13-month window we are currently in is the primary arena for action.
Those who use this period to audit their grandfathered dates, map out their intent, and stress test those dual scenarios are the ones who will dictate their own terms.
And those who wait.
Those who defer action until mid-2027 will just find themselves having reactive conversations. They'll be scrambling to comply with algorithmic constraints, entirely missing the window to capitalize.
So for you listening, whether you are a financial professional managing a large trail book, a property owner, or just an insanely curious learner, grasping these underlying mechanics gives you a massive advantage. You understand exactly why lending data and property transaction volumes are going to behave so erratically over the coming year.
Understanding the mechanics of a transition period like this provides the ultimate clarity in a chaotic market.
It really does. Now, before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final unmentioned ripple effect to ponder. It wasn't explicitly analyzed in the source material, but it builds directly on the mechanics of the grandfathering cutoff.
Let's map it out.
Consider those pre-May 12 established properties. The grandfathering provision protects their negative gearing status and the 50% CGT discount indefinitely, right?
Indefinitely, yes.
However, that protection only applies to the current owner. The moment the property is transacted, the grandfathered status evaporates forever. The incoming buyer falls under the new rules.
Right, they get the new harsher rules.
So, if selling an established investment property means destroying its irreplaceable, highly leveraged tax status, will current owners ever be incentivized to sell? Or are we about to witness a massive, permanent freeze in the supply of established investment housing?
Wow. You are looking at the creation of a permanently closed asset class. The holding value of the property could vastly outweigh its liquidity value.
Exactly. The new rules of the board game didn't just alter the rent calculations. They may have structurally incentivized half the players to never return a single property to the market. It is going to be a fascinating behavioral shift to observe.
It truly is.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the source material today, and we will catch you on the next one.